Welcome to episode 9 of the QSO Today podcast. I'm your host, Eric Guth, 4Z1UG. My guest today is John Portoon, W6NBC. W6NBC, this is 4Z1UG. You there, John?
Good morning, Eric, 4Z1UG. Go ahead.
John, thanks for joining me on QSO Today. You have a long and colorful ham radio story. Will you start at the beginning and tell us how and when you entered the hobby?
I think my journey in ham radio goes right back to my youthful days in the 1950s when electronics began fascinating me in those days. Of course, it was all vacuum tubes and things and then. And a kit my father gave me to build a radio, which I did. From that day onward, it was just upward. But I didn't get interested in ham radio, though I knew about it in the background. Ham radio has always been difficult to find out how to become a ham. But I was already in college at Oregon State doing my physics degree and but building projects. So I went over to a local town that had a ham radio store in it because he had parts. And I went in to buy some resistors and capacitors and things like that. And got to talking to him. His name was Howard Truax, now a great old figure in the local Oregon ham world. Mm-hmm. And he was an active ham, W7SO. I spoke to him later when I became a ham, and he pretty much put the spark in me. From that point onward, it was all upward. But I didn't become a ham until it was some years later.
So you're kind of a late bloomer.
Yeah, I suppose you can say that.
Uh-huh. Was Howard, would you consider Howard your Elmer?
Yes, for quite a while there. I lived in the little town of Albany, Oregon, and he encouraged me to study the code and so forth. And I didn't become a ham at that time, but it was already in my blood. So it only took me some time to get back to it.
Uh-huh. And what did you operate then? What was your first rig?
Well, my first rig was a Drake pair, an R47 Drake pair. And by this time, I was living in UK in the United Kingdom as G5AJH, a reciprocal operator. I had obtained an American call sign, but I had never used it. I got it reciprocal from England.
Uh-huh. And why were you in England? What happened there?
Well, I was teaching, basically, and doing news photography.
And what did you teach in England?
No, I was teaching at a local grammar school, actually, uh-huh. And what might be considered a community college in England.
So were you, when you were in England, you were operating the Drake pair?
That's correct.
And what was the operating mode that you liked to operate then?
Oh, a single sideband and some CW. And a little radio teletype.
Uh-huh. So where did you go after that? Because I see that you also ended up in broadcast television. Did that start in England?
I had an interest in it in England, but nothing professionally happened there. I came back to the United States when my first wife became terminally ill. She subsequently died where I was living in Los Angeles. And I kicked around quite a bit in those days doing a variety of things, but eventually got a job at NBC in Burbank as a technician on their television crew.
Did you work in the studio or were you on the broadcast transmitter site on Mount Wilson?
No, I wasn't on the hilltop. I went to the hilltop a number of times, but no, this was in the main studio of KNBC Los Angeles Channel 4.
And your W6NBC, does that have anything to do with the KNBC call sign where you worked?
Well, it was a desire for almost all hams there to have an NBC call sign. Uh-huh. It was quite an active group at NBC. But when the vanity call came out, I beat them. I got the call sign, and a couple of my buddies were unhappy that I did.
And tell me, what kind of a community was it at NBC in terms of ham radio?
Oh, there must have been at least a dozen good hams, and we used to have a regular meeting, and we had a station there at the studio, which I helped to build, and we had a regular net that went on for years.
Did amateur radio play a part in opening the doors for you in the broadcast industry?
I don't think so, although I always listed it on my on my resume, and the person that hired me happened to be a ham. So that, I think, may have helped some.
Were you always active in amateur radio in your professional life?
I've always been a ham. It's been the main avocation of my lifetime, although I've done many other things, flying and scuba diving and digital photography and sailing and things like that. But ham radios, I've always considered it to be by far my number one hobby, and it's had a profound effect on my life.
Yeah, we could talk about scuba diving, I'm sure. That's one of my favorite activities outside of ham radio as well. On your QRZ page, you talk about that you work 160 meters to 2.4 gigahertz. What do you do on 2.4 gigahertz?
I haven't done a lot on 2.4 recently, but when I was using it, I was using it as with my amateur TV station, my FastScan NTSC TV station.
Uh-huh. And can you talk a little bit about FastScan television, at least the way that you were using it?
Well, yes, indeed. I was working at Ampex Corporation, you know, the famous tape recorder producer, and there were hams there too, and they had a ham station there that had been that had been put in by the founder of Ampex Corporation, who was an active ham. I became the kind of runner of that station for a while, and because we had TV equipment and I was teaching broadcast television equipment maintenance for Ampex, we put a relatively professional station in, and of course I wanted to do something with it, so I set it up with 2.4 down and 440 up.
How does that work exactly? You actually had a repeater that was repeating the
FastScan correct.
Television?
And yes, there was a major TV or amateur TV repeater on Black Mountain, which is one of the major mountains surrounding the Bay Area in San Francisco. And there was another one at Mount Diablo, which I used to use, and that used 1.2 gigs and would regularly join the weekly nets there on amateur TV, FastScan TV.
And FastScan TV is operated the same way as like push to talk, release to listen, and that when it was your turn to transmit, you would transmit and the video signal would go along with it?
That is absolutely correct. It's just a normal type QSO, except because of the video, it isn't as quick breakish as most nets are.
Can you walk us through a little bit of what a conversation is like on FastScan television?
It really doesn't vary a great deal from what happens normally in a rag chew. They're typically rag chews, except that since there's visual presence, sometimes most of the operators would bring things to show and even play little video snippets if they had the capacity to produce them.
Mm-hmm. And how large was that FastScan community up there in the Bay Area? I mean, this is absolutely new to me. I mean, I've been a ham for 41 years, and I've never even considered FastScan television. But this is fascinating.
Well, it's an interesting activity, mostly in getting it going and participating in it for a while. But because the community is relatively small, you end up pretty much knowing everybody and seeing everything they have to show. So after about 2 years, I got a little bit tired of it and have never returned to it.
Okay. And where do you hang out mostly when you're on the air?
Now, you mean?
Yeah, now.
Well, because I happen to strongly believe that ham radio is principally a social hobby. Uh-huh. Of course, it's technical too. My main activity and the majority of my friends are all hams, and we meet on local nets here, and we have breakfast together. I have very few friends that aren't hams.
Well, it's my understanding that you're also big into ham radio education, and that you're a volunteer examiner, and that you run courses. Is that correct? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, indeed. That's probably my two really main ham activities are building and designing, making things, and writing articles for QST, which I've written, I think, 13 or 14 now. And the other one is running this quarterly program in which we bring people in and give them a license in one day. I know there's some difference of opinion as to whether that's an effective method, but I think the results of the fact that about at least a third of the people on all the local repeaters here are my graduates. So I run this quarterly, bring them in one day, help them read the pool, and give them the test, and it's absolutely effective.
And how many graduates would you say that you've, or how many licensees do you think have come through your program?
I began the program in the Bay Area while I was still working for in the television business for Sony Electronics. In fact, I ran my first one of these sessions at Sony Electronics with largely a bunch of engineers from Sony, and just brought them into a classroom where I was teaching for Sony, and let them read the pool for 6 hours and gave them the test. And the success rate has been over 90% ever since that time. I've run hundreds of sessions since that time, and the program continues in the Bay Area under one of the people that were helping me do it there. And if I count the number of people that have come through the program, it has the number in the several thousand.
Oh, that's amazing. So here I thought that the increased number of licensees in North America, almost 60,000 a year now, had to do with natural disasters and Hurricane Katrina. But little did I know that you have a program in the Bay Area that's also cranking them out. I think it's great. By the way, so what happens to these hams after they – are there supplementary programs that kind of pick up from there in order to help them, move along to the higher license levels, but also, introduce them to the various other areas of ham radio?
Indeed. I have a very strong philosophic belief that hams need to be encouraged to get involved with their local hams and clubs, breakfasts and nets and that sort of thing. And that's principally what I do. When I give this quarterly program, I give them a lecture on how to become an active ham and not just to fade away and try to do it on their own. And so I'm a strong advocate of getting them to come to all of these local ham activities. And almost all that do become active hams, and they're my buddies and friends on the local repeaters, I say, which are largely, a good many of them there are from my program.
What is the secret of a short-term memory? And how do you use it in ham radio?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. I simply bring my people into a classroom. I don't lecture to them about ham radio, which many other clubs and hams think that's the way to get them licensed. I simply bring them into a room, put them down, put the question pool in front of them, and have them read it in 6 45-minute reading periods, 15-minute break periods. Read the pool, read the right answer, and move on. And then at the end of the day, I give them the test. In practice, this is based on short-term memory. You simply read it, you remember it. Mm-hmm. Now, and it never fails to have a 90% success rate. We've had people as old as 92 and as young as 10 years old go through it. And the ones that don't pass it usually are those that just don't try very hard, or who have perhaps language skills, or are too young to have enough of an attention span. Mm-hmm. But normal adults from 16 years up through 90 years, their success rate is in the high 90s.
Right. So the question pool is about, the question pool is what, over 100 questions for the technician class?
But it's actually 630, I think.
So 630 questions, but there's then only 35 questions on the test?
That's correct. But it's taken pretty systematically from the pool.
But you mentioned that you write articles for QST. I actually looked at your list of articles that you've written for both QST and Popular Electronics, which, as you say, you have a quite a lengthy resume. But interestingly enough, they're all they differ in subject. So it's not like you're writing about the same antenna year after year, or article after article. You're writing about a lot of different things. What drives you to create and share these articles with your fellow hams?
Well, my teaching career, which is pretty extensive at community college, I taught for some time at Pasadena City College and another church school that I was affiliated with loosely. And teaching and speaking and public speaking is, I suppose you have to say, not exactly my hobby, but it's really in my blood. Like Bob Hope, who never could get off stage, mm-hmm. not because he needed the money, but because he just enjoyed being on stage. I love to public speak. I give lectures at any radio club that'll have me. I talk regularly. I even want to start lecturing on the internet, which I used to do a little bit of. And so it's my love of public speaking that really causes me to do it. And writing is only another form of public speaking, as far as I'm concerned.
What's your favorite subject in ham radio to speak about? If you have an audience, well, you have an audience right now. What's your favorite subject to speak about?
Oh, without question, it's antenna theory. I think antennas are probably the one remaining bastion of real homebrew in the ham radio community. Not that I'm against the modern rigs. They're beautiful. Mm-hmm. But the days of the Heath kit is long gone.
And so if you were going to speak to us a little bit about antenna theory, what do you think is the biggest challenge that ham radio operators have nowadays?
Well, that's, of course, a very broad question, but I think it mostly goes back to just a fundamental understanding of the real basic physics of how an antenna performs, because there are so many things people believe, so many things hams believe that are just not true. I think the classic example of this, which Walter Maxwell used to write a lot about, to the famous forget his call, MU or something like that, the fact that a lot of people believe that an antenna tuner does not tune an antenna. Well, it does. I'm sorry. The antenna is the composite, including the feed line and the tuner, not mm-hmm. just that piece of wire hanging in space. That's something I often, hammer on.
Well, I guess people who say that might be thinking that because they're using an unbalanced line out of the antenna tuner to the antenna that perhaps it doesn't work the same way that the old balanced, Pi network tuners used to work into a balanced line up to the antenna. Is that?
Yes, the advent of coax, mm-hmm. which I think was about 1956 or something like that, changed this whole view quite a bit and probably caused a lot of hams to believe that you had to do all the tuning up in the antenna or it wasn't any good. But frankly, that's not true. I run, for example, a non-resonant flagpole in front of my mobile home, which is not tuned to anything, mm-hmm. and it runs about 20 feet of LMR 400 into an auto tuner. Because I have the background in physics, I carefully worked through what kind of losses am I experiencing with the tuner and that feed line in there, and they're trivial. And I work all over the country and the world on this 20-foot flagpole in front of my house.
Well, so there's an interesting antenna subject, and that is that if you're operating a flagpole in front of your house, then you're in a community that's subject to codes, covenants, and regulations. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. That's why I'm such a big advocate and talk a lot about this. I forget the name of the bill that's currently in the House of Representatives, 4963 or something like that, to break the stranglehold, which I almost consider Hitlerian, over restricting hams with covenants and conditions.
So then, interestingly enough, then I see that you wrote an article in QST about loading up a rain gutter. Did I misunderstand that, or did I get that right? And if that's the case, do you have some ideas for people that are living in restricted communities in terms of what they can do in order to put a great signal out in the air?
Absolutely. Of course, as we all know, ham radio is not having a 10-element beam 200 feet high and a full-gallon amplifier.
Mm-hmm. Although we all wish that.
We all would like to have it, but the truth of the matter is the real people who work the big contacts, people at the top of the honor roll, are sometimes working with very modest equipment. Uh-huh. Anyway, far as stealth antennas, that probably would be the sort of subnote of my antenna interest. Because I live in a small mobile home, being retired, mm-hmm. I like that kind of a community. Stealth antennas are of interest to me. I do indeed have a I call it a rain gutter loop, but actually it's a wire loop that's about 1 foot high around the edge of my mobile home. And it works. It works just fine. It obviously has some losses. It's not a six element beam, but I certainly work many contacts from it.
And what kind of rig do you operate now?
Well, at home I have at home and in my car I have principally two ICOM 706 Mark IIGs. They constitute my main radio Corral. The one at home, of course, has an old ancient eighth kit SB220 linear on it, which mm-hmm. I run into the loop, run into the flagpole, but I run one in the car too. But I also run a remote base station with a Kenwood 2000 in it from a mountaintop at Vandenberg Air Force Base nearby. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a military person myself. And I do a lot of work through that, which is, of course, a much more elaborate station than the one at home.
Do you want to speak a little bit more about what a remote base station is and how that works
sure.
for you?
This is a Kenwood 2000, which is probably the most liked remote base station HF, VHF, UHF radios used for remote basing. It sits up there and it connects to a computer. The computer connects to the internet, and users get on the air with a simple piece of free software, and they can run this remote base station from all over the world, any place there's the internet. We have members of the club. We ask people to join the club, which, by the way, is sponsored by the Satellite Amateur Radio Club, called that because we helped launch the first Oscar. And if you join the club for $20 a year, you can run the remote base station anywhere in the world. And a lot of people do. We have members in Europe and the UK and all over the United States that run this remote base station, which sits at 900 feet high on a hilltop on Vandenberg Air Force Base.
And does that remote base have any like UHF or microwave input on it so they can be operated mobile, or is it just only a internet remote base?
Well, you operate it from the internet. Mm-hmm. We are going to add a 440 local link to it so you can run it. People running around the community can run it too. Mm-hmm. That's in the process yet. But no, it has VHF and UHF, all local repeaters and stuff, all modes and so forth. Does PSK and all that kind of stuff. It's lots of fun. Gets used quite a bit and fun to use. When you tell people you're running remotely from your laptop sitting in bed in the morning, which I'm doing right now, uh-huh. and they think, oh, that's unusual, but it works very well.
What kind of antenna system is on it?
At the moment, there's a Cushcraft multiband vertical. We're hoping, of course, to expand that to a rotary beam. The control software can handle a tunable beam, mm-hmm. and we're in the process of purchasing a more power. It's at the moment just running barefoot, but that'll go up as time goes by.
Well, I would imagine that being 900 feet above the beach there, I think at Vandenberg, that it has some amazing signal off to the Far East.
Oh yeah, it certainly works well over the ocean, Australia, uh-huh. and Japan, or any time you want.
Can we go back a little bit to your vertical? I mean, certainly people who are also in restricted communities, the idea of putting up a flagpole is an interesting one. To put up a 20-foot vertical, or do you operate that 20-foot vertical on the lower frequencies like 80, 160, 40 meters?
It is really only effective down to about 40 meters. Mm-hmm. Can be run on 80, but the losses become pretty high. And on 160, it will work, but I don't use it on those bands principally. It's a 20-foot flagpole, center-fed. The coax runs up the bottom through the antenna itself to the center. Mm-hmm. Hence, it's a full half-wave antenna. It's not a quarter wave. Does not use radials. There's no place for radials in a mobile home park. And so I have to use a center-fed half-wave antenna, which, of course, I'm a very big advocate of myself as verticals. I think the compromise that most hams run into trying to put a few verticals down for a quarter wave HF vertical, mm-hmm. the losses are so terrible.
How did you build it? What'd you build it out of?
it's built out of the familiar camouflage poles that you can buy on the internet.
The aluminum ones.
The aluminum ones and fiberglass. I use a fiberglass for the insulator at the bottom, a cutoff piece.
Right.
The feed point, which is in the middle, is another 1 foot of the fiberglass section.
Oh, interesting. And so you bring the coax right up the center, and you split it. Are you using some kind of a balun?
Yes, indeed. There is a ferrite choke balun, a 1-to-1 current balun, right at the top of the coax, which then gets just fed with a pair of wires to the aluminum poles.
Do you have plans out on the internet for that antenna?
I have the article written for QST. I haven't sent it in yet, but I'll go post it on my website. I usually post my articles both to be published and that I have published on W6NBC.com, my regular website for promoting my testing sessions.
Okay. You said that you were involved with the Satellite Amateur Radio Club. Were you involved in any of the OSCAR development and deployment?
No, that was before my time, but the club really played a very active role in the launch of the first OSCAR-1 satellite, hence the name of the club. And our remote base station, you can stand up there and look down at all the what they call slicks or the launch complexes. I've witnessed many launches from that very location.
It's my understanding that there's a fair amount of amateur balloon activity out there in California in terms of taking packages, radio packages, up into the stratosphere. Is that done by your club at all, or have you been involved in any of those kinds of activities?
No, we've never gotten involved. I think the Cal Poly group, which frequently comes and joins us, is involved in that. Of course, they're involved in the CubeSat project. The only kind of other activity that we've ever done at the club, other than helping the Boy Scouts do JOTA every year and Field Day, of course. I was the chairman for it. We did run a contact with the International Space Station from the Lompoc High School, which was a wonderful event that happened about a year or so ago.
Do you, Elmer, any kids at this point or other new hams on an active basis?
Well, I have a number of people who call me and ask me that I'm always helping out. And, of course, we do run a very active JOTA program, the Jamboree on the Air, which is just coming up, I think, in October. And we have a building up on the base that the base lets us use. It's it was the original place where they first had GPS reception stuff when it was big stuff. And we have the building, and it's our clubhouse, and we have a nice large plot of ground where we can put up and do things. And so we invite several scout troops up at the JOTA event, and they have loads of fun getting on the air.
You mentioned that you're a pilot. Did you combine flying with amateur radio when you were active? Are you still an active pilot?
No, I've not. I had heart problems some years ago, which are well taken care of now, which took me out of flying. I flew briefly after college. Just little simple tail draggers and that kind of private flying, just puddle jumping, but I never combined radio with it.
On your website, you talk about commercial radio licenses. Do you actually, you obviously have a commercial radio license if you work for KNBC. Do you also provide training sessions for that?
We don't do any sessions. I do give the tests, however. My testing team is a COLEM, as they call it. And we can give any one of the commercial licenses, which we do, and we frequently give license at field days and at swap meets and even local breakfasts and club meetings. So we try to make licensing as easy as possible.
Do you think it's important or helpful for a ham radio operator to also pursue the commercial licenses?
Oh, I don't really think so. They're fine. They the FCC has been pulling back in their requirement of them. I guess you really don't need one anymore. I think about the only place you find the commercial licenses being required actively is in the maritime world, where ship captains and other things need them.
Yeah, surprisingly, I've heard Gordon West, WB6NOA, speak a number of times on Ham Nation about the opportunities for people that live near, you know, bodies of water to certify and recertify radios that are in vessels. But and that seems to be, as you say, the only place where we're having an FCC license is required. I even think for land mobile communications now that having the FCC second class is no longer required.
No longer required, unfortunately. I've held what was the first class since 1960, even before I became a ham. And, of course, it's now the general radio phone, as well as the others. I've just done them for the fun of it. One of the ones that I have obtained, which I'm kind of proud of, but has no practical value whatsoever, is I hold a second-class radio telegraph license, mm-hmm. which used to be required for the ship-to-shore stations, such as the big one up at Point Reyes, north of San Francisco, which is a wonderful visit, by the way, for anybody that ever gets by there to go by and see that old CW ship-to-shore station. I enjoyed going up there and visiting them, and since I had the license, they let me go on the air, and I actually got to transmit 35,000 watts of CW one day.
Did you talk to anybody as a result of that? That wasn't in the ham band, was it?
Oh, no, that's on right. That's on ship to shore, right at the old 500 kilohertz frequency, as well as several shortwave frequencies where they simulcast. And they rarely make a contact anymore. And all I did was send out a bulletin.
Mm-hmm. How fast is your CW speed?
Oh, I can lump along near 20.
Uh-huh. Oh, very good. You said that you had some other ham radio subjects that you were interested in that you would speak about. Besides antenna theory, what other amateur radio subjects excite you?
Well, they have been quite wide, but radio propagation is certainly something I've looked into a lot. The thing I'm working on right now is really quite interesting, is the switchover from battery types in portable equipment, where the nickel metal hydride NiCads are pretty much vanishing from the battery world and being replaced by lithium ion batteries, mm-hmm. pushed on along a lot by the electric car industry. I understand that the new Tesla has 6,500 of these little batteries in them, and I've been replacing all the batteries in my handheld tools and stuff with these lithium ions, and have been learning how to spot weld them, and I'm currently developing an article for QST on how to home build a spot welder so you can fix your battery packs.
Well, that sounds very interesting, and I look forward to seeing that. It's a good question, though, in terms of if you're converting to lithium ion batteries, do the chargers that came with the original radios, will those chargers work with the lithium ion batteries?
Absolutely not. No one wants to ever try to do that. You need to bring your battery terminals out to the outside and use an external smart charger designed for lithium ions. They're relatively easily available and relatively inexpensive, and as well as the lithium ion batteries, because mm-hmm. of the many places they're being used now.
Okay, so that's a word of warning to hams out there that are converting batteries to lithium ion, that you want to make sure that that you actually have the right charger and don't use the stock charger that came with the radio originally.
That is correct. One of the most common uses of the lithium ion is to buy one of the packs meant to, for HT, for example, that uses alkaline batteries. Mm-hmm. And then you put, of course, because the voltage on a lithium ion is 3.6 compared to 1.2 for a NMH, mm-hmm. You only want to use 1/3 of them and some dummy batteries in there. But they work fine that way.
Will your article include information about chargers and charging apparatus that could be used for retrofitting some of these walkie? I think probably the radio that seems to be the most popular because of the price is the little Baofeng radios. Are those lithium ion already out of the? Do you happen to know out of the box or?
they're lithium ion out of the box. So you've already got the technology there. It's your older radios that sometimes don't have lithium ions in them. But if they have an alkaline pack, then get that and put lithiums in it with some dummies to make up for the voltage difference.
What's the advantage of the lithium ion battery if we're talking batteries right now? It seems to me I'm pretty sure that that's what I have in my iPhone 4S. And
I have lithiums in my iPhone too
as well. And it seems that I'm always plugged into the battery charger. So I mean, obviously, I think the 4S eats batteries, or it eats the battery pretty fast. But I don't seem to have a problem with memory, where the battery somehow remembers that it's being charged all the time.
No, that is correct. The principal advantage of the lithium ion is just energy or current density. Mm-hmm. One lithium ion, for example, let's say in a AA size, is equal to 3 nickel metal hydrides, both in voltage and in total capacity. Mm-hmm. So they're amazing in their current density. Their other main advantage is that they have excellent shelf life. You can leave them for months and months and they still have the same charge on them, where nickel metal hydrides or NiCads will go dead in that period of time. The one danger with the lithium ions is you don't let them drop below about 2.5 volts. They can swell up and explode if you do that.
Because they're being they're over discharged.
Yeah, they do not like undercharge. So that's why most of the lithium ions today have little smart boards in them to make them into smart batteries. That's what your cell phone, that's what your iPhone has, and mm-hmm. all modern equipment has little smart board in there.
As we're talking about batteries, are the batteries, the lithium ion batteries, are they as sensitive to cold? I remember taking a bunch of Boy Scouts up into the mountains of Colorado and taking the ham radio with me, and my NiCad battery pack didn't like being cold. I had no voltage. But what about lithium ion batteries? Are they better for that?
Yes, the lithium ion batteries are better for tolerating the cold. The lithium polymers, which you sometimes find in model airplanes and stuff like that, do not like cold. But the lithium ions are better than NiCads or NMHs.
You mentioned on your QRZ site that you have an interest in pipe organs. Can you speak a little bit about that? It's off the ham radio topic, but it's interesting to see that people who are into ham radio can also be into a whole bunch of other things as well.
Well, I don't think any ham has just one hobby if they're a real ham.
We, in fact, had
a discussion the other day over breakfast as to how many hobbies does a ham have and what are the common hobbies. Uh-huh. And I think the opinion was most hams are into ham radio, flying, guns, shooting, and I forget what the fourth one was. But anyway, you talk about pipe organs. I'm a big classical music buff. Uh-huh. And so pipe organs are have a big genre of organ music in the classical world. And I got to going to visiting major pipe organs around the Bay Area. And so it's just a big interest. The closest I've ever come is to build a calliope, which was a 64-note wooden calliope, mm-hmm. which was run from a laptop computer under MIDI control. And we used to have it in the parade here locally in Santa Maria. Going down the street, the computer's playing the calliope. It was a lot of fun.
So a calliope is essentially pipes with a pump and some valves that open and close the
That's right. The They're really relays with a felt pad on them that open the chamber that brings the very low pressure, high volume air up from a blower, basically.
Mm-hmm. So you built one of those because I had pictured that perhaps you had 8 octaves of pipes, in your living room or something like that.
If I had a bigger house, I might be tempted to do that. But mm-hmm. since I decided that the mobile home allowed me a lot more free time in retirement, it works just fine. So there's no room for a pipe organ. In fact, my ham station is relatively small, too.
Why the ICOM 706 Mark II? If you've got two of them, Why did you choose ICOM over all the other stuff that's out there? And this isn't a commercial for ICOM. I'm just curious because I've met a lot of hams who are, you know, using different things.
Well, I don't think the company name matters too much, although ICOM has a pretty good reputation. I've certainly owned and I currently own Kenwood radios and Yaesu radios as well. Right. So I've tried them all, as well as the Puxings or the Puxings, as I guess they're pronounced, and the Baofangs and so forth. There's hardly a radio brand I haven't tried, Asdens and so forth. Certainly all the Heathkits and the Drakes and all that stuff too in the past. But I forget what you actually asked, so ask it again.
Well, I asked you why you chose the ICOM 706. If you're looking for a small rig to use both in the car and in your house, what was the reason for choosing the 706, and what was part of your search in order to make the determination which rig you wanted?
Well, that's fairly easy. Not because I consider ICOM to be a lot better than Kenwood or Yaesu. But the ICOM seemed to enter that all-mode, all-band VHF, HF, UHF mobile radio market the first. Kenwood and Yaesu now have equal radios that I could use just as well. So it's just a matter that they were the first and I wanted one because I was running mostly mobile at the time.
What's the wrong way to do CW?
The wrong way to either learn it or use it. Which is your question?
Well, I'm looking at your website, and you actually have an article here, The Wrong Way to Do CW. And I'm wondering if that's the wrong way to learn it or the wrong way to present it.
Neither. You need to go look at the video and see what it is. It's a little video clip from the Three Stooges in which they're standing by an old telegraph key, and all of a sudden you hear CW in the background, and it's just the typical Three Stooges routine. It says, "Oh, shortwave, take that down." So you hear it in the background, and one of them's writing it down, and Curly says, "Well, what is that? What is that? What is it said?" And Mo says, "He hits him in the head as usually he does." So it's just something fun.
Okay, I thought perhaps that there was a philosophical discussion there. What advice do you give new hams in terms of what they should do to explore the length and breadth of ham radio?
Well, that is a very easy question. I think I've already mentioned it. My question is, my recommendation to all new hams is don't go it on your own. Don't decide by yourself what equipment to buy, what to do. Mm-hmm. First thing you want to do is get with local hams. Join the clubs or go to the club meetings if you don't stay as a member. Go to the local ham breakfast. Get with them for a while, and you'll quickly learn what's fun in ham radio, and you'll quickly learn the efficient ways to do it.
Yeah, I heard a guy on the on one of the repeaters last week say that he had just bought, you know, the Yaesu FTDDX 5000. And was considering using a buddy pole for the antenna. And I'm thinking, you know, he needs an Elmer. He needs somebody to, you know, get together with him. He's got a $9,000 transceiver, and he's going to, you know, load it into a portable antenna.
So, yeah, that's that typical example of going it on your own. You think you know what it is, but how many hobbies have you entered in which you went out on your own and bought the starter kit, and then 2 months later, after getting with the other people in the hobby, decided, uh-oh, I shouldn't have done that. You finally go out and buy what they're using, and that's what you keep using.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm a fellow scuba diver, so, I mean, obviously anybody that learns how to scuba dive knows that you always do it with a buddy. And when you do it with a buddy, I personally, I'm still only, and I've been diving for years, but I'm still at the entry level. Maybe because I don't dive enough, but I always dive with a dive master, and it seems to me it's the same as in amateur radio that as you're going into the hobby, it always pays to go with an Elmer that has a lot of experience and a lot of background in order to be able to, you know, steer you in the right direction.
You're absolutely right. If you're going to do it seriously, and if it's not just something you'd like to try out and then forget about, you want to find out what the people are using and what they're doing and where they're going and what activities they're into. That's likely to be what you want to do. And that's what I tell my my people at my ham sessions.
Well, John, I've appreciated the time that we've spent together here. And I know it'll be quite interesting to the listeners. Do you have a parting shot before we go?
Well, my parting shot would be, of all of the people I have known in my life, I think the most consistent friends I've had over the years have been hams. When I go back to England, where I lived for nearly 10 years, I only go back, and the only people I remember there or that I ever get back together with are hams. They seem to me the most helpful, the most useful, most reasonable and decent people I've ever known in my lifetime.
Well, I'm with you there 100%, and I can tell you that I still have childhood friends who were hams that I'm still in touch with, 40 plus years later. So that's a great parting shot. John, 73, I appreciate so much your coming on today on QSO Today.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that wraps up our interview. Please visit the show notes page for this interview and any of the other earlier interviews at www.qsotoday.com. You can use the search box in the upper right corner and search on my guest call sign to find the episode that you want. If you are a new listener, I encourage you to go back to our earliest podcasts and start from the beginning. Keep in mind that we are in the iTunes Store and are distributed in podcast format on Stitcher, where all of the episodes are available. I welcome your feedback and input. There are a few ways to do this. You can leave a comment on the show notes page under the guest interview. This is also a great way to get our guest to reply directly to you. If you sign up for our QSO Today community, I will also put you on the QSO Today mailing list. I promise not to spam you or send your email to anyone. John, W6NBC, was kind enough to send me his article on his flagpole antenna that has not been published yet, and I will be happy to send it to you if you sign up for the QSO Today community. If you would like this article sent to you, please push the button at the top of the QSO Today podcast website to sign up. Finally, if you join our community, you will have access to the community through our closed Facebook group. The Facebook group is an ideal setting to discuss the issues raised by our guests, to suggest future guests, and to provide feedback on the show and its production. That's all for now. 73 from me, Eric, 4Z1UG.